What is this?
It's called cyberfunk.
I can read. Makes heavy metal look like Alice in Wonderland.
It's cartoons.
You think this is funny?
Hey, would you stop taking it so seriously?
Hello, everybody. This is Again with This, episode 60. Let's watch Thomas Calabro on Law and Order. And now, here are your hosts,
Tara Aranio and Sarah D. Bunting.
Chung Chung. Hello, Tara and Dave.
Hello.
Hello again with this Patreons. Thank you so much for your support. Today we are traveling far back into the past to the unlamented, grievy era of Law and Order Mothership, on which Thomas Calabro, Michael Mancini, played a variation on Robert Chambers named Ned Loomis in season 1, episode 4, Kiss the Girls and Make Them Die. We have some notes. Tara, any sort of overarching thoughts about the Greevy era before we get into it?
I don't hate Greevy as much as you do, but they definitely were trying more at this phase to like lay in character notes about both of the cops, particularly less so with the DAs. Mm-hmm. But we definitely are like, okay, this one's like a young tomcat and this one's an old married dick. Got it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that ended up being their dynamic the whole time.
Yeah, it's true. And that was actually kind of the Logan dynamic with most guys he was paired with.
Yeah.
Until he got Staten Islanded. But enough about that. In its first season, Law & Order, famous original, ripped from a tri-state or national sometimes crime headline in literally every single episode. This one is their plausibly deniable take on Robert Chambers, aka the preppy murderer. Just a little background for y'all who don't have this like stitched on their bone marrow like I do. Chambers, a fatuously handsome Upper East Side kid who looked like he was straight out of private school Topher Central casting, was also a serial klepto with substance abuse issues who moved in Manhattan's tonier circles thanks to the committed striving of his Irish mother, who was a nurse for some bishop or another. That Chambers killed Jennifer Levin in Central Park August 26, 1986 is not in dispute, but he claimed when he was tracked down by NYPD that she wanted, quote, rough sex, and when it got too painful, he shoved her off him and she hit her head. It was an accident and, of course, her fault for basically existing as a woman outside of her own home. Literal newborns heard that explanation and were like, nope. But the case lived in the headlines of local papers and TV stations for years after that and was actually the subject of an AMC docuseries in 2019. Not to mention vaulting one Linda Fairstein into the public's esteem. Blech. And people argued about every aspect of this case, the privilege of both kids, whether Levin had a sex diary, as alleged by Chambers' attorneys, the credibility of his defense, on and on and on and on. And as usual, with these early ripped from the headlinesers, Detectives Mike Logan and Max Greevy, excuse me, Sergeant Greevy, are obliged to situate the audience in the issues with Greevy on the brayingly wrong side of history 92 to 97% of the time. Here, he is about to illustrate why women didn't and don't report sexual assault to authorities, clip 2.
What, she's 24? What's she supposed to do, act like a nun?
My kids today, they do drugs. Sex is like a drink of water. No wonder they get in trouble.
Oh, wow. And I thought my old man was a pain in the ass.
What the hell is that supposed to mean?
I feel like that was pretty clear, Maxie, but all right. This is just one of, like, 4 iterations of this conversation, by the way, in which Greevy is like, she asked for it, and Logan is like, just let people fuck, Dana. Goddamn.
Seriously.
Anyway, later, as they try to track the victim's movements in the last hours of her life, Logan and Greevy end up at the episode's version of Dorian's Red Hand. And the maitre d' may not have the best eye for who Thomas Calabro looks like, but he's right on about Logan, clip 3.
Cashmere blazer, Hermes tie, my kind of people.
And way up there in the looks department, the young Warren Beatty. Are we your kind of people?
Well, you make it in the looks department. The wardrobe needs a lot of help, though.
I don't know. Logan's leather jacket always did it for me, even with the flag pin. But the more I thought about that Beatty comparison, the more it started to track for me. Yeah.
The nose and mouth and the dark hair and the, you know, that cocky charm. Mm-hmm. Like, Calabro is, I would say, like a more ethnic Warren Beatty, but they, you know, probably aren't going to say that.
Yeah. The problem is that Beatty has that same patrician jaw and bearing that Chambers did and mm-hmm. does. Thomas Calabro, less so. Why don't we let guest star Haviland Morris, aka Caroline in 16 Candles, lower a tea light into the canyon that is the class divide in this episode in clip 4.
Ned Loomis. All-American boy. Exeter, Princeton, Harvard Business School. He dated Paige up until the spring. Her parents loved him.
Did she love him?
She didn't love him, she worshipped him. They were sort of engaged.
What happened?
Ned comes from one of those families. Great-grandpa started a widget company, made enough money to last forever. Except for one thing.
Someone spent all the dough.
Ned got left with a great name, no money.
I had in my notes that I clipped this for two reasons, but there's a third reason, which I'll actually lead with, and that's that her timbre is like super reminiscent of Marcia Cross, which mm-hmm. I sort of just realized when I was clipping it.
Yeah.
The real first reason is that I Googled around and I could not find it, but I could swear there is a spreadsheet or a blog entry online somewhere of all the Law and Orderverse perps across the franchises who went to Princeton.
Oh, yeah.
It is a lot of them.
Yep.
This is true to life. Anyway, if anyone knows where that is or wants to create it, if it doesn't exist, at me, I will totally help you. Tomato Nation on Twitter.
Yeah. There's like kind of two sorts of rich person stories on Law and Order, mm-hmm. which one of them is they're so rich, they're going to get away with it. And that sucks. But that's life in this bitch of a world. And they are pretending to be rich, but they're not as rich as they seem.
Yes. Yeah. And I find that the ones where they're so rich that they don't understand how the world works. Mm-hmm. The money has turned them into sociopaths. Uh-huh. They tend to have gone to Yale.
Ah, interesting.
And then if they're just like born bad, then the Strivers always went to Princeton because that's where crooks go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that reminds me of the one with the father killed the mother, and they had all matching pins made that had their initials on them, and that's mm-hmm. how the guy that was having an affair with the dead lady figures out which pin that was found with her was the right one.
And that's one of the Lauren Ambrosodes involves the kid who had gotten into Princeton, but like the fact that his dad was a janitor was like
really
embarrassing.
Yes. Wasn't that Gabriel Olds?
I think so.
Yeah.
Anyway, Princeton, don't go there. First-hand info. Okay. The second reason I clipped that is that Morris is just one of the great guest stars here. Dennis Boutsakaris making his Orderverse debut as Loomis's lawyer.
So good.
The omnipresent, hey, it's that avuncular and harmless vice principal, Adam Lefevre, who, as we're recording this, is celebrating a birthday today.
Hey!
Happy 71st, avuncular guy. he is a bartender. I don't think he shows up in any of my clips. And then, of course, Calabro. So we arrive back at the Calabronundrum. Mm-hmm. To wit, he is, in my opinion, miscast. He is too short for one. I know that's just something that we all have to live with when actors are playing, quote, real people, but add him to the list of bros trying to get over with 5'10 on their IMDb page. And no, he is handsome,
but he's a short really. Kid. We know.
Yeah, he's a short kid. There's like a couple of pictures where he's between the two of the mm-hmm. Logan and Greavy.
Yeah.
And like even Greavy is sort of looming over him, which like Greavy just looms, but he's also kind of a fire hydrant of a guy. Like,
yeah.
Okay. Calabro is handsome, but not really in a preppy way. And his performance is fine. He gets like relatively little to do compared to the women in the story, which is also fine and also, like, kind of accidentally progressive of the show to do it that way. Not to mention that old Bootsy is doing enough acting for him and five other people, but Calabro is fine. He's to Brooklyn, clip five.
God, terrible. I actually saw her the night she died.
Saw her.
Look, could we schedule this for, say, tomorrow? These people are very close to an offer.
Look, any help you can give us, we will come.
You're leaving the appliances, right?
Oh, yes, everything. And that includes the Wolf Range and the Sub-Zero.
The furniture?
You can move right in.
Excuse me, what agency are you with?
Homicide.
Oh. I just love that. That's like one of Greavy's four good lines that he gets to get off. The other one is when the little girl's like, "Are you the man?" And he's like, "We sure are, honey," which I've always liked.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I agree. The backstory should have been he was striving to jump, striving for class mobility, shall we say.
Yeah.
Because he is. He's too ethnic. He doesn't read preppy. He reads as like the janitor's kid who got a scholarship or something.
Yeah.
Like, you know, that nothing to say. This is not to say I agree with these values, but like he's not WASPy enough.
Yeah. And there's definitely like there's another scene where Logan overhears him saying what Chambers was alleged to have said, like been overheard, which is like, you know, I shouldn't have let that bitch get me.
Yeah.
And sort of playing the victim. And this happens, or this used to happen, I feel like, early in Melrose when he was still like a good guy and they were trying to make us care about, like, you know, the plight of the young marrieds.
Right.
That he was trying to present as a more like newscaster English guy.
Yeah.
And then once he did the heel turn, he could just code switch to the way
Brooklyn
I have to talk
guy.
When I'm out in Bay Ridge so that people don't know I went to Princeton and think I'm a crook. Just kidding. It would actually be on brand for the bookshop. But anyway, he's fine. He just is not quite right. And the whole thing that sort of drove this real case was that all the weird subcurrents of New York class shit, especially it was transitioning into from the 80s where it was still this fairly scary place to the 90s and it being more like corporate Disney Giuliani Bloomberg era.
Yeah, that he just doesn't have the look for the backstory that we heard in that clip of like coming from such old money that it could have set up everyone for life, but now it's gone, but the name still matters. Like, this is not this is not the story of that face.
Yeah, no, it's not. He's just not quite right, and it's not his fault. That might explain why, despite conservatively, I'm going to guess I've seen this episode a couple dozen times.
Oh, same.
I still managed to forget that he was in one at all. And I certainly did not remember that it was this one. Mm-hmm. I think I thought that he was one of the co-defendants in that. I think it's also the first season and I forget what it's called. But
the one that Philip Seymour Hoffman and Gil Bellows are in.
Yes. The murderer's row of guys who raped a journalist.
Yes.
Like in a stairwell.
Yep.
Yeah, I thought he was either in that or he was one of the, this is a later episode, I think this is a Soretta era, but you know the one where Espo and her tiny backpack are racist and it's always like, oh, like what time is it right now? Are they gonna bleep her saying the N-word?
Right.
Sometimes they do.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they just cut it, which fine, like we got it.
Right.
But I, for some reason, thought that he was, like, in that one somewhere. Like, mm-hmm. I never would have guessed it was this one.
Yeah.
So.
But to get back to the rip from the headlines aspect of it, when we were talking about it on the main show initially, I was like, he's like a Ted Bundy type, which is wrong, obviously.
Right.
You've established, but, like, maybe that would have worked better as, like, the guy who's killing nurses.
Yeah, I think I thought the same thing that I was like, yeah, you know, Stark weather, like, why not? I mean, they found it was mostly New York-y cases.
Yeah.
I also got confused and thought that this was the one that was aired out of order instead of what they filmed as the pilot.
Right.
Everyone's favorite Bagman, which then was like a two-parter in episode six. And actually, you learn something new about Law and Order every day. It's still possible. I found out that these are their stories. Narrator Zern Kilton is actually in that episode in the mobile unit where they're watching the restaurant.
Get out of here.
And he says something like, can you believe these Moes or something like that? And it's like, oh, I'm going to have to go back and watch that too.
Yeah. Paul Guilfoyle is in everybody's favorite Bagman too, right? As a bad guy.
Yeah. Scalise. The mobster, he's in a few episodes, and then I think he gets killed, and then I think his family has Greavy killed.
Right.
Spoiler for a 30-year-old show. but this was super enjoyable. They don't tend to air this far back on the reruns on basic cable for whatever reason. I would much rather watch a Greavy-sode than a Govich-sode. Sorry, girl.
Yeah. I agree.
But yeah, he is good in this, and I think that he could have in a time before this, if he hadn't gotten Melrose, he probably would have been like Adam Lefevre. He would have just been in like 9 Law and Orders.
Oh yes, yes.
4 SVUs.
Yeah.
Couple criminal intents. Once as the bad guy. Once as a crime scene tech. Like. Yeah, because he was New York-based, and then he got Melrose, so...
Yeah. God love him.
Yeah, don't go to Princeton. Look, it's good advice.
Your fantasy begins now.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Again With This, episode 64, a whole bunch of people in their Fantasy Island episode. And now here are your hosts,
Tara Aranio and Sarah D. Bunting.
Dave.
Hello, whole bunch of people. Hello, Tara and Dave.
Hello.
And hello, Patreon supporters. Thank you so much for your support. We really appreciate it, and we couldn't not, on your behalf, watch 3 Melrosians in a Fantasy Island reboot episode, right? Especially not one that's basically a meta-meditation on aging in Hollywood and societal double standards. Our speciality! So we hope that this will make up for the 90210 novelization fantasies that keeps getting delayed. But again, episode 69
nice
of this podcast should be a banger. Nice. In the meantime, we are talking about a more accessible property. Season 1, episode 6? 7?
Six.
There was some numbering confusion.
Six.
I believe it's 6. Of the Fantasy Island reboot, The Big 5-0, with special guest stars Josie Bassett, Laura Layton, and Daphne Zuniga. The episode aired September 12th, right? Okay. There's a link in our show notes, so you can watch it on Hulu if you like. And you might like. I'll give you the episode summary quickly, and then Tara and I are going to talk briefly about whether we sort of like the show generally. Anyway, here is the IMDb's take. Quote, when old friends Nettie, Camille, and Margot, and Phyllis, I guess, missed the plane, come to the island to celebrate their 50th birthdays, their fantasies expose fault lines in their friendship. End quote. I was never a watcher of this show as a kid, and had not been watching this reboot, despite thinking Rosalind Sanchez, who plays Rourke, is the shit. But I might start.
Yeah,
you?
It's enjoyable.
Are you watching this? Yeah.
I talked about it on our sister podcast, Extra Hot Great, right after it premiered. It's very slight, but
yeah,
that's fine. It's very enjoyable, and it's super episodic, so you know, if one comes up and you're like, I don't care about this fantasy, you can just not watch it. Like, it's a fine show to dip in and out of. It aired on Tuesday, but now it seems like they're double blasting them. So there's a Tuesday episode and then the Sunday episode is different. I thought it was a rerun, but it's a very weekend
double
show.
Blasting.
Well, whatever.
Nice.
It's such a Saturday night show, like the original
it
one
really
was.
Is
like it's just yeah. It's very turn your brain off and just let the beautiful Puerto Rican landscape soothe you and these people's dumb problems, knowing that they're going to be solved within 42 minutes, and they always are.
So let's dig a little further into the problems. Nettie, that's Laura Layton, is recovering from a divorce. Her husband gave the lie to their high school sweetheart, romance, and seemingly insta-perfect life by cheating her on her with a woman who lives on a houseboat. The show keeps mentioning this as if it's like a misdemeanor for some reason. It sounds pretty rad to me, if I'm being honest, team mistress. Like, way to live on a houseboat. That's cool. Camille begins the episode played by Sarah Chaney as a fuller-bodied version of the character, is a single cat-owning, quote, girl boss, blech, who once the friends reach the fantastical island, is then played by Josie Bissett as part of her fantasy of, we think, initially being played by Josie Bissett. But it's not actually, I was like, when are they going to finally nail their we're not fat shaming theses to the door of this episode. They finally do. It does not do the most convincing job with that plot twist. And also, I'm not totally sure everybody in the writer's room knows how a boob works.
Yeah.
Like, what is an actual, organic boob supposed to feel like? Maybe no experience with that. Anyway, I did appreciate the shout out to myself in clip two.
You're smoking hot.
I had no idea anything like this was ever possible.
It's completely bizarre. Can I feel them?
Yes. They're like beefsteak tomatoes or something.
Nett, you want to grope?
I'm good.
You wanna grope was extremely charming, sorry. It turns out that all the obsessing over KM's boobs was because she was diagnosed with, then defeated, breast cancer on her own without telling either of her besties. Not entirely convinced the ep got away with this, but sure, they have a certain way they have to do this and things they have to do in 41 minutes. They do that fine.
Yeah, I thought it was, I bought that she was like, they have enough going on right now that I'm going to be the rock for them and not demand it in return.
Right.
Because their problems are, their problems are not nothing either, but go on.
Yeah, but I it was sort of edging up to the idea also that she felt like she's not allowed to have problems in this friendship where she's the one without children, and the writing lost its nerve about that, which granted, that's a really tough tightrope to get across, so
I agree.
Fine.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I buy that too.
I mean, the acting mostly sold this stuff. I'll talk about that more in a bit, but let's wrap up with Margot, played by Daphne Zuniga, who is exhausted after having had triplets at the age of 47. Her fantasy journey starts out extremely relatably with just wanting to take a nap in the middle of the forest while surrounded by fruity alcohol drinks. But then it ends up in this saccharine place of self-care and making time for mom's own needs. Again, she almost sells it, but this is a Saturday night show. They're not trying to. Not trying to really displace the patriarchy with this. There is some infighting among the friends. There's some, quote, humorous attempts by Ruby to get Rourke to participate in a traditional girls' night, which includes Segundo wearing a hilarious gold chamomile facial mask and Rourke trying to nudge Ruby towards the girl side. There's Rosalind Sanchez being absolutely magical to watch. Even if you have it on mute, I could just stare at her all day. She is so beautiful.
Yep.
She is 10 days younger than I am.
Oh.
10 days, guys. Don't smoke and drink. It's good advice. Wish I'd listened to it. And she's also wearing lots of pretty outfits. They all are. They're doing many, many consequence-free rounds of shots. Enjoy that. And there's a couple of in-joke nods to Melrose, including clip 3.
I will tell all if you finally fess up about what happened between you and that hot neighbor you had back in the early 90s.
Motorcycle dig?
Yes.
I'll never tell.
Why not? What's the harm?
Yeah.
I was not a watcher of the original, like I said, but this is both like so toothlessly chuggy, basically. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I'm using that word. I'm probably going to get arrested for using it at the age of 48 and a half. But anyway, this is like just toothless, but also charming and unchallenging in the best way.
Yeah, this is the TV equivalent of a glass of white wine with ice cubes. Mm-hmm. Like, it's that, that's the vibe.
Absolutely.
And I mean that as a compliment.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like, or like colored mascara, I would say.
Yeah.
Like, do you need this? No. Is it fun? Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. And I also liked how in some scenes, especially when the friends were like trying to like break each other, break the friendship down and build it back up, like those parts of the episode, I liked that they were as much about these actors reuniting and talking to each other about their relationship with each other and mm-hmm. Hollywood and being an actor who's over 50. And P.S., Zuniga is almost 60. She's in her late 50s. She, like, everyone looks fantastic and appropriate.
Yep.
And I just liked that dialogue, there was that sort of meta dialogue that wasn't in the dialogue. Mm-hmm. So I found that interesting. And, you know, these are pretty people who are good at their jobs.
Yeah. I agree that the writing of the friendship, especially a three-way friendship like that, where there are going to be factions that like sort of assemble and then come apart.
Yeah. Yep.
That I thought that was well done, especially Camille having to be the one to be like, Margot resents Nettie for talking her into parenthood later mm-hmm. in life. And that's another thing where I thought they lost their nerve.
Yeah.
In really pursuing that, because once you have the triplets, you can't really say like, oh, this was a mistake, you know, because now you have them and that's your life, you know. But
yeah.
I thought they handled that well. And that Laura Layton as Nettie was also very good once Camille has her transformation of mm-hmm. being like not okay about it. And obviously, like, at some point, Camille accuses her of not liking to share the spotlight. And it's clear mm-hmm. that is the case. Like,
yeah,
that in her mind, Camille was, you know, as the phrase goes in the Mae Whitman movie, like the designated fat friend. Mm-hmm. And Nettie did not like to be unseated from her like starring role as the main character of this friendship, basically.
Right.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's, I mean, she admits as much to this very attractive, but not terribly good at acting fantasy doctor that yes. she meets. And yeah. And then there's like a coffin. It's like, who's going to be in it? I mean, parts of it are just like ridiculous. And the internal logic of Fantasy Island is as bizarre and malleable as I guess the old one always was.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, and Ruby is fun. I like that character.
She is fun. So. She's she's a young woman playing a 75 plus year old lady who's been turned back into a 20 something. And so she does stuff with her voice to like make herself sound old and busted. It's just very funny. It's a very funny role to play for this woman.
And watching the actor who, like, this woman in her 70s sort of struggling with, like, her, you know, fluid sexuality on Fantasy Island and trying to find words for that that aren't too 20-something.
Yes.
That's pretty clever, the way they did that part. It was, I mean, it was fine. It was, like, this little truffle. It's fine. It's a good show. They did a good job.
Yeah. There's, like, prestige TV has its place, and we all like it. There's also a place for shows like this and Dynasty, which we also talked about not too long ago. It's like the same kind of thing where it's just like, let it wash over you. you don't have to think. It's better if you don't, in fact.
Like, yeah. Well, and especially when our work week is like A, long, and B, thinking about prestige shows and sort of analyzing them. And it's like, oh, there's nothing to analyze. This is a single-celled organism that is just a single sequin. Yes. Thank you.
Yeah.
More.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the, I mean, the closest they get is with the, you know, the potentially fat phobic storyline, and then the explanation that's like, no, I didn't, I wanted a different body. I didn't want a smaller body. I just wanted one that was different.
One that worked. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I felt like my body betrayed me.
Yeah.
And, you know, as you said, I don't know if they 100% got there to probably every viewer's satisfaction, but I, you know, they sent her home in her old body being like, I'm great. My life is great. I love being a childless woman and I'm going to help Nettie have a career because she needs one now and she never did before.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, yeah, great.
Yeah, fine.
Mm-hmm.